This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Later in the program, we meet two artists breaking new ground in Charlotte. Both are visually impaired, but neither has let that curtail their creativity. One is a dancer. The other creates experiences for groups of people that do not involve sight. They both join us later in the program. First, we look into charges that the Charlotte region's largest mental health care provider has abused public dollars. Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions took over as Mecklenburg County's mental health care provider in 2014, but a state audit highlighted executive compensation that was more than allowed by state law and which the state auditor called unreasonable. Cardinal contends its practices are proper and that the spending in question makes up a small slice of its overall costs. But state scrutiny has led to their slashing of their CEO's pay substantially. WFAE reporters Tom Bullock and Alex Olgan have both been following this story, and we asked them to join us to unpack the intricate details. Welcome back to the program, both of you.
Thank you.
Good to see you. We asked Cardinal Innovations to provide us with a representative for this program. They declined, saying that they had spoken to Alex and answered her questions to the best of their ability and did not believe they could add anything new to this conversation, but they did note they would be happy to revisit an interview following their November board meeting. You can join this conversation by email at WFAE.org. Join us on Facebook, where we're broadcasting live, or this morning on Facebook Live, or on Twitter at Charlotte Talks. So why was this audit of Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions undertaken in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question, and it all goes back to Republican lawmakers in the General Assembly. Now, you said in your introduction, Mike, that Cardinal is Charlotte's largest mental health provider. It's actually the state's largest. It covers 20 counties.
And they want to expand.
And they want to expand. But it's 20 counties. By Cardinal's own estimation, they covered the Medicaid cost of 850,000 patients. It's about one in four Medicaid recipients in the state. So they are the single largest player in this market in the state. And the reason they were set up, it's kind of like a decentralized or almost, not completely, but almost a privatized system. Lawmakers set this up as a way to control costs and to hopefully get more bang for their taxpayer dollars. Mm-hmm. So they established these LME MCOs, which is just a fancy way of saying, you know, groups like Cardinal. They give federal money, state money, and county money to these groups. And those groups, almost like a contractor on a construction site, they do some of the work and they outsource to subcontractors other parts of the work. But lawmakers were really disturbed by the fact that Cardinal in particular had a pretty significant war chest that they were sitting on. They about $70 million, and that's just one. That's on the low end of the range that I've seen. $70 million of taxpayer money that wasn't being spent on patient care. And they went and started asking Cardinal questions. And according to the lawmakers, Cardinal would not answer their questions. So they asked basically North Carolina's top taxpayer watchdog, the state auditor, Beth Wood, to investigate, to do an audit. And that's where we come up with the very first audit.
So in Mecklenburg County, Alex, you're our health reporter. In Mecklenburg County, who would be the recipient of their services? What kind of situations do they involve themselves in with patients?
Well, it's behavioral health care usually, and it's a lot of Medicaid patients. So, you know, people that have Medicaid can be in a whole variety of situations. It can be because their parents don't make enough money. It can be because they have certain disabilities that qualify them to be Medicaid recipients. So it could be a whole host of people. As he said, it's hundreds of thousands.
And is it strictly to the health department, or is it private individuals who would see them because they require those services in that way?
It's actually not done through the health department. It's done through these, you know, individual companies. So you have Cardinal itself, which does provide services. And these range from mental health disorders to substance abuse, opioid abuse, veterans services, you know, services and training for, say, an autistic individual or someone with Down syndrome. So it's a really wide scope that they work in.
And it should be pointed out here, I guess, that this investigation into this organization, Cardinal Healthcare Services, did not question the quality of care that they're giving the patients. It's only about how they're using taxpayer money.
And that is a very important point. They found nothing in terms of Medicaid fraud, but that's also because, and they point this out, we only looked at the compensation packages, the salaries, the benefits, the potential severance packages. So that is something these audits did not look at, did not cover. So I don't want to infer one way or another right. whether something's going, but no, of course they didn't focus on fraud.
So you said, I believe, that they're in 20 of North Carolina's 100 counties,
correct.
Which means 20% of the state. Why did Mecklenburg decide to outsource their mental health care to Cardinal? Was it their decision or was it the state's decision?
It was the state's decision. And this goes back a few years ago. People, as you mentioned earlier, people remember MecLink. It was the mm-hmm. you know, the county's mental health provider. State lawmakers basically wanted to create a more efficient system, and they wanted to whittle down the number of these LME MCOs from at one point 39 to get down to a smaller number, and the number they shot for was 7. Mm-hmm. They originally wanted less, but that's where we stand at now. So there are 7 of these groups across North Carolina, and Cardinal is by far the largest.
So their budget in 2016 was reportedly just over $682 million, and worries came to light, I think, late last year in December of 2016, perhaps. And in May, Tom, you wrote that hoarding $70 million in Medicaid money that should be spent on patients while spending lavishly on CEO pay and luxury board retreats were just some of the findings laid out by this audit. If you're making $682 million, is $70 million a lot of money to put in a slush fund, or was it a slush fund? Were they spending that money? Is that the lavish spending they're talking about, that $70
million? No, and it's here's where we have to really start parsing things.
Right.
And it's important to remember this. Cardinal is not a for-profit company. So it is not your classic, you know, private institution. It is also not a full nonprofit company. It's this amalgam. It's this blend, this hybrid of the two. It is still part of state government but has certain exceptions. So by federal statute – one of the ways that federal law tries to encourage companies like Cardinal to find efficiencies, in essence saving money, is that if you're given a bucket of money and you spend it on the things you're supposed to spend it, but if you find ways to save money, that's yours. And that's the way that the federal system is set up. The questions that lawmakers began raising was not that core concept. It was the volume of the concept. And I keep using this $70 million range. That is at the low end of the estimate. I haven't been able to tag down yet exactly how much money Cardinal or the other groups that are like it have saved. I've seen estimates, you know, upwards of $270 million that they're sitting on. And it's important to note that while they're sitting on that money, they have a wait list for patients seeking care that they do provide. Mm. So it's not like they've met the need and they reap the benefits. There is still a wait list that is not being addressed.
And just a fundamental thing to point out about managed care organizations is, as Tom mentioned, their whole goal is to streamline care, and they're looking for savings by making the overall person healthier, mm. by making their care more efficient.
And by saving money, they make money? Is that essentially how it happens?
Yeah, in theory.
So the $70 million is the money they made on trying to come up with efficiencies and streamline care and services. So
that's one point of view. But the other point of view on this is that wait list still exists. So should they be saving money when there are still patients
waiting
that qualify that aren't getting care?
So they should be adjusting their fees accordingly or expending more of that money on more doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals. Is that what that's what the allegation is or the feeling is?
That's part of it, yeah.
Is there any need to dwell at all, because I don't know, on the differences between nonprofit organizations and not-for-profit organizations? Is it simply splitting hairs at this point?
No, I don't. I mean, if you really want to get deep in the weeds here, we could actually get into that. But the key thing to remember is that Cardinal straddles this line, and that can create some very dark gray areas that it operates in. And I'm not implying anything in terms of, you know, misallocation.
It's just not clear.
The rules are vague.
Okay. And that's one thing. Actually, I talked to one of the board members who's also a Mecklenburg County commissioner last week. And that was one of the things he said. He said it was really unclear, according to him, about, you know, exactly how the state governed the organization. And that was one of the reasons that the board was unclear on the salary.
As I was reading through some of these stories, apparently there are county commissioners throughout the state who are members of the board mm-hmm. of Cardinal. Is that unusual?
Well, yes and no. It's unusual because North Carolina is still figuring out these boards. But at least, you know, you have people who have some mental health experience. And there is a standard that the state sets. In theory, that would create a qualified board. It's not clear to me yet whether or not that those you know.
But go ahead. But if you have elected officials on the board of directors, and the board of directors sets the compensation levels for the executives, do they not know the law? Because one of the problems here is that as a not-for-profit organization, I understand it, there's a cap, a state law mm-hmm. capping CEO compensation at $187,000, and Cardinal was paying its CEO
– is paying.
Okay, $630,000 oh. No, they've changed that.
I'm sorry,
$635,000 a year plus a 40% bonus amounting to an additional $254,000 plus yeah. – hold on. This all may have changed, but this is what they were doing, plus a long-term incentive package of $412,000 to be paid over several years. Now, were people like this county commissioner you refer to and others who from other counties who were on this board unaware – of the salary cap? Really?
So just one
really?
I just want to back up one quick point because there were a lot of numbers in that
yep.
statement.
Yes, there were.
So as of last Tuesday, the board approved a resolution to pay the CEO $204,000 in change. And I have not seen that resolution, right. but they tell me that that salary change took effect last
right,
Wednesday.
And we're going to talk
yeah,
about
yeah, yeah,
that.
Yeah,
we're
yeah,
going to talk
yeah,
about
yeah.
that.
So when
like,
I –
this is what they were planning to do. And that's my question
yes,
is
yes.
do they not know, the people on the board who work for governments around the state, not know the law?
So that is what George Dunlap, who is the Mecklenburg County Commissioner and the board member I talked to, that's kind of what he said. I pushed him and I asked him a question about that. And here's a little bit of the exchange.
The board did what it thought it had the authority to do.
Right. But what I'm asking you is not whether or not you had the authority or whether you were within regulations. But my question was, do you think it was a responsible decision given that it was taxpayer dollars?
Well, let me ask you this. Because I also helped make the decisions about the county manager and other people, if you're asking me if I think it's a responsible decision to pay market rate, then I do. Because I believe people ought to be compensated for what they do and what their worth is.
And that's what the Cardinal keeps going back to. They claim that his pay was market rate, according to similar people in his position, and that's from a consultant study.
How many patients do they serve?
850,000 by their count.
So how does that compare to the number of patients served by CMC?
I have no idea. I don't know. But again, these are in different brackets because CMC is going to deal with everything from a leg sprain to serious surgery to childbirth. So obviously they're going to have a much wider patient population.
So Cardinal contends that the Office of State Human Resources gave its approval on these compensation levels that we were just talking about. Do we know if that is in fact the case?
Well, and I do think we should get into the specifics of the first audit because there's some key points to bring out. But I'll answer that question obviously first. The Office of Human Resources says no. They never got the approval from the state for this executive pay. And in particular, with this first audit, which was done again by the state auditor Beth Wood, I asked her specifically about Cardinal's response, which was, "Hey, we always submit all of our salary schedules to the state. We've never heard anything back in terms of this as a problem." And what the auditor told me was that's everyone except the CEO. So obviously there are two lines of thought here. The state sees Cardinal in breach of what is state law. Cardinal says, not so fast. We are not we're not a nonprofit. We're not a full profit. This is that gray area I was talking about. So we have to pay market rate. But it's also worth noting that Cardinal CEO makes so much more than everybody else that's in the state that does this. Next highest salary, $217,000. So he makes $400,000 more.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more on this in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Greer Walker, a Charlotte-based CPA firm serving middle-market companies in the Carolinas and by its affiliates, Greer Walker Wealth Management and Greer Walker Corporate Finance. Details at greerwalker.com. And Catawba College Salisbury inviting prospective students to Sport and Health Science Day on November the 4th, including information about career opportunities in these academic fields. More at catawba.edu/special events. Well, the challenges of raising digital natives, the topic of this program tomorrow. You may have noticed these days everybody seems to have their faces buried in a screen, and that includes children. So what age should your children be allowed to have their own phone or their own social media account? How much screen time is too much? What do they need to know about how to use these things intelligently, and what is this all doing to them and to us? We get some answers and some tips tomorrow at 9.
For decades, California cities have grown outward, and that's put a lot of houses in wildfire-prone areas. As the state recovers from this month's fires, some see an opportunity to break that pattern.
Now we need to do it, you know, stop talking and planning, but actually start building in the right places, in the right way.
Growth Without Sprawl, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up this afternoon at 4 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the little kerfuffle within the state about Cardinal Innovations Healthcare Solutions and the amount of money they have been paying their CEO. Tom Bullock is with us from WFAE News, and Alex Olgan is also with us. She's our health reporter here at WFAE. There's some murkiness in all of this, and some of it's the state's fault probably, and not just Cardinal's fault, because there seems to be some dispute about the organization's status. The auditor, the state auditor, says they are not independent of the state. Cardinal believes they are. They're an independent contractor, which would change the way they operate and the rules under which they operate. So who's right, and why is there confusion?
Again, that gray area I was talking about, but something that's really interesting is, and this is a subset that we can also get into if you like, but mm-hmm. Cardinal has actually now filed a petition, a legal document, challenging the state's finding, and not only Auditor Woods' audit, but also a subsequent audit from the State Department of Health and Human Services. And in Cardinal's own complaint, they acknowledge that they are a subdivision of the state. Now, that phrase is going to be key in this case, because what they're saying there is we are, in fact, subject to certain rules. So that, to me, was an interesting twist.
And in one of the audits, the auditor points out that this may be partly OSHR's fault, the Office of State Human Resources, because they didn't enforce this lower salary. And as to the status of that case, I guess, so to speak. I know the complaint has been filed with the state. The Cardinal says they're not changing the complaint, even though they already reduced the CEO's salary. And the state sort of hasn't given me any clarity on where that stands. But they just basically contest and say, look, State Office of Human Resources, we disagree with you. Now, there was a sequence of events where, like, in May, they were sort of notified of what the salary range was. And in August, they were sent a letter saying, hey, look, you're above the salary for your CEO. You need to fix this to get in compliance.
Let's go back to the salary situation. In May, when CEO Robert Topping's $634,000 salary was exposed, he said he is said to have requested the board reduce it to $400,000. He was going to do that voluntarily, and that was approved. But recently you reported, Alex, that the board lowered it to $204,195. That seems rather specific to me, which is the maximum allowed under state regulations. He's not going to accept that, is he?
So what happened at that closed board meeting, I don't know for sure because I wasn't in the meeting. It was closed. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, I went in there and the chairwoman during open session, and the chairwoman said we offered it to him and he said he couldn't accept it. However, Cardinal has said since that he is still the CEO. So as I know it today, mm-hmm. he is still the CEO. And as I know it, his salary is $204,195, which is the state allowed maximum.
So he volunteered to reduce it.
I'm not aware of
that. I'm not actually sure that's a fact, because honestly, as it may be a fact, but then you have to ask yourself a simple question, which is if he's volunteering to do it, why wasn't it done? And why wasn't it done prior to this? Because we do know that as of this meeting that Alex went to, it was still, you know, $600,000 and change.
So now they voted, the board voted to reduce it to the state sanctioned level, but they also, I understand, earlier sued the state to maintain what it claimed is the authority to pay their CEO the original salary, which is 3.5 times more than his peers. On what do they justify that level of compensation?
And this is the court case I was just speaking about. And they say it's all based on the fact that Cardinal is a very large company, has a lot of money, and it's based basically in Mecklenburg County and in the Triad area. So they used an equivalency scale. They hired a third-party group to go out there and say, okay, what would somebody be making in a similar company? Now, I haven't been able to see that report yet, because one thing that's interesting is who are you looking at? It's like real estate. It's, again, like buying real estate. If you're looking at the nicest houses in the neighborhood,
right,
you're going to find out an average cost that's a whole lot more than, say, a comparable house to what you want to buy.
And I just want to quickly point out, I have asked Cardinal and I've also asked the state for that independent third-party study, mm-hmm. and they claim they can't give it to me because it's not public information. So we don't know what's in that study, and I can't get it as of now.
So is $204,195 a year a market rate salary, or does it put them at a competitive disadvantage? If he decides to walk because it's not enough money for him to live on, can they find somebody to run the organization?
So that's one of the things they say in this court complaint or this petition that they wrote to the state, was that you're doing us irreparable harm because we're not going to be able to find someone. Mm. I don't know if that's true or not. Mm. But it would be interesting to see.
Yeah. Can I add something to that, though? There are, again, seven of these organizations across the state, right? Cardinal is just one of seven. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the salaries of the other six, mm-hmm. they are all, with just one other slight exception, in that salary range. So, you know, the only two companies that are slightly out of that range is VIA, which is based in Asheville, and their CEO gets $217,000. So that's just $13,000 over the cap. And then you have Cardinal at $600,000 and change. So we're talking significant difference.
So how do they get over the cap in Asheville?
I have no idea.
All right. That was just one of the things. Just the salary is only part of what they found when they did this audit. They also found these severance packages that purport to pay these executives full salary, I think, including benefits, mm-hmm. for 2 years, whether they quit or are fired.
This is key, and this is actually a second audit, and this mm-hmm. second audit is important because it was done specifically by the Department of Health and Human Services, and they control Cardinal's contract, so they can turn off the spigot of taxpayer money. Mm-hmm. And what they found is they agreed with everything in the first audit that the state auditor found, which includes not just the CEO pay, but some claims of possible nepotism by the CEO, these expensive board retreats where they would take the board down to Charleston and, you know, have a meet for 6 hours, but the trip would cost, you know, $130,000 for that. So a lot of extravagance. So these severance packages can be triggered by almost everything, mm-hmm. almost everything. The CEO severance package is 2 to 3 years full salary plus medical, and that can be triggered by a drop in income, changes in law, changes in it's almost an open door to leave right. with this platinum parachute. And it's not just him. It also includes 10 top employees, and they can also leave if the CEO does. Hmm. So it creates this potential of a conflicting circle where you almost wonder if the top 10 employees are more beholden to the CEO than they are to the company that they're there to lead.
So with these junkets, or these, not junkets, these were retreats where the board met, and they met in Charleston, and in one instance they paid $133,000 to do this and met for 6 hours, which comes out to about $9,000 an hour. Again, is this against the law, against the rules? Is it merely bad optics? What is this?
The answer is it's not against the law, mm-hmm. potentially. We don't yet know. That needs to be ruled on. But I will do two things to answer this. The first thing is, ask yourself, if this was done in any or other organization that was part of the state, what would the outrage be? Mm-hmm. If this kind of taxpayer money, because this is still taxpayer money, if it was used in this way, what would the outrage be? But the second thing I want to bring up is actually an interview that I did with Amy Kendall, and she is Cardinal's chief administrative officer. Mm-hmm. She's in the C-suite. Here's how she explained these retreats to me.
Our board consists of 13 individuals who volunteer their time to participate on the board. And so we make every effort possible to ensure we are meeting at a location that is convenient for all of them, because they all have full-time jobs.
Okay, but this is in Charleston, South Carolina. All of your counties, the 20 counties, are in North Carolina. It seems like there would be a more cost-efficient place to be found in North Carolina as opposed to the Carolina to the south.
I hear you on that. I think I would focus everybody back to the fact that the that entire finding three relates specifically to 0.34% of our total administrative spend.
So her answer was, yes, but this is really just a small chunk, and she's right, actually. Her percentage spot on. But it's still being used in that way. And it is worth noting a slight clarification that Alex has found. The board members aren't just flat out volunteers. They do get paid $50 per meeting. Now, obviously, that's more of a stipend than a salary, but it's worth noting.
And it is also worth noting that the board has decided to since not hold any more offsite meetings.
Okay. Now, does this audit, these two audits that uncovered all this financial information, does this constitute, will this constitute the entire investigation into this organization? And will these audits, besides changing the compensation of the CEO, change the way this company operates going forward, or any of these types of companies throughout the state change the way they operate going forward?
So there have been changes to the Department of Health's oversight of these groups, not so specifically about salary, but I did talk to the Secretary of Health, Mandy Cohen, on Friday, and she mentioned to me that she put some other measures in place to keep more oversight mm-hmm. of care and actually withhold payment if they're not meeting these metrics.
Whether it's related to this salary issue or others, we are taking using all the tools that we can to hold all of the LMEs accountable, not just for salary, but frankly for the service delivery that we expect of them. So if you look, for example, at the new contract that we did with the LME MCOs this year, starting back in July, it's the first time that we have clinical performance measures.
And it is important to point out her deputy, Dave Richard, who's over this investigation, says they're still trying to get Cardinal in compliance. One of the things left is the severance packages. Mm-hmm. Cardinal did say they were going to address that in their November board meeting. However, it is important to note they just scheduled another board meeting for Friday.
So all of this was precipitated because legislators could not get answers to questions they had about the compensation package and other operational situations at Cardinal. And
correct.
So they launched an audit. What has been their reaction to the audits?
Outrage. I think it's fair to say pretty much outrage. And that's from both sides of the aisle because, again, this is taxpayer money. And, they've already cut before these audits actually came – well, in between these two audits, lawmakers actually have already cut the budgets for these LME MCOs, mm-hmm. for groups like Cardinal, by tens of millions of dollars. And the reason they did that, at least as they stated in the debate over the budget, was because they were sitting on these war chests, this unused money, but they still had wait lists. So just as an example, I happen to have the chart here with me. Cardinal, just this fiscal year, will see its budget cut by $20 million from state money and an additional $24 million next budget.
And these legislators, or at least a bipartisan group of state legislators, has urged State Health Secretary Dr. Mandy Cohen to replace both topping the CEO and the board and or terminate the company's state Medicaid contracts for noncompliance with state laws. Is that likely to happen, any of that?
That's one thing that the department has said that they're looking at, mm-hmm. and they're giving Cardinal a little more time to get in compliance. So I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, and it's important to note that even with everything that's going on here that we've talked about with Cardinal, they are in charge of providing, and do by all accounts, it seems, mm-hmm. provide really important care. Now, quality of care, there are lots of things that Alex and I are still digging into. But what they do is very important. And what's fascinating to me is there's actually a clause in the contract and in state law that allows the Secretary of North Carolina's Department of Health and Human Services, Ms. Cohen, to, in effect, take over Cardinal or other similar groups, at least for a short period of time, mm-hmm. and make these kinds of financial changes. But first, they have to let the board have their say and try to make corrective actions. And it's not clear if this is the process that's currently underway, but that is a tool the state does have at its disposal.
And would it be clear? Would it be fair to say, given all the things we've talked about today, that Cardinal is an outlier when it comes to organizations like this in terms of the way they operate and compensate both their boards and their executives?
I would say an outlier in terms of the way they compensate their CEO okay. in the severance packages. I can't speak to the other operations, but as he mentioned, the audit included the six other LME MCO pay for the CEO, and it was three times less.
And do we understand why they chose to do it this way?
Define the who.
Well, understand why Cardinal chose to pay their CEO so much when it's so much more than other comparable organizations.
That independent consultant study is what they cited. And it's important to remember that the current CEO right now uh-huh. was previously the general counsel at this organization for years.
Okay. Again, we asked Cardinal Innovations to provide us with a representative for this program. They declined, saying they had spoken to our reporter, Alex Olgan, who's one of our guests in this segment, and they answered her questions to the best of their ability, did not believe they could add anything new to this conversation, and volunteered to come back and be with us again following their November board meeting. So that's right around the corner. Mm-hmm. Alex Olgan and Tom Bullock, both from WFAE News. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
Well, two Charlotte artists with visual impairments are not only creating art, they're finding ways to share that art with other people with and without disabilities. Carmen Papalia lost his sight in college and now describes himself as a non-visual learner. He is artist in residence at the McCall Center for Art and Innovation, and in partnership with UNC Charlotte, his art is social practice, which we'll talk about. It isn't object-based, but rather experience-based, and we'll let him explain that as we go through the rest of the hour. Carmen, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. David Robinson is a UNC Charlotte student doing a double major in dance and exercise science and currently working in a student dance production. Welcome to you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm great. Let me turn your microphone on so we can all hear you. Good morning again.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Dr. Karen Hubbard, Associate Professor of Dance at UNC Charlotte. Thanks for being here today. Carmen, you described yourself as a non-visual learner. What does that mean?
Well, since I started using a mobility cane when I was 21, I'm 36 now, I started just maybe like interrogating the things that kind of just came standard with that disability identity. So one of the ways that people tend to identify when they use a white cane is they identify as blind or visually impaired or low vision. I mean, all one has to do is type the word blind into dictionary.com and find a list of synonyms, kind of describing the different associations to the term and realize, you know, why one might not want to be called blind. So, I mean, early on, I just started trying to resist those kinds of various ways that I felt positioned by this disability identity and started calling myself or maybe just slowing down the conversation by describing myself as a non-visual learner.
And from what I've read about your work, you're actually a non-visual teacher.
That's right. I'm here through a teaching residency through the McCall Center. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm teaching a class at UNC. I'm teaching an installation class. And what my students are doing right now is reconstructing an environment that they experienced with eyes closed.
Okay. How did you lose your – because you were 21, you said, when you lost your
eyes? Yeah.
How did you lose your sight?
Well, it's a hereditary condition. I don't usually use like medicalizing language to describe myself. So like whenever you think about those standard things, the questions that people ask, like, you know, when – I mean, I get asked all the time, when did you lose your sight? And I often first say, you know, I don't think of it as a loss because I think when I shifted the value from the visual to the non-visual, my world opened up in a sense. I feel like I just, you know, I was able to identify different kind of different experiences that I wasn't privy to while I was focusing on the visual.
We're going to talk about your art and what you're doing, the kind of experiential art that you're creating and how other people can experience it and enjoy it. We'll also talk to Davian Robinson, who is a dancer without sight, and Dr. Karen Hubbard, who's an associate professor of dance. But we have to take a break, and we'll do that now. We'll come back with more in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and College Foundation of North Carolina and ncapplyforcollege.org, helping North Carolina students plan, apply, and pay for college. ncapplyforcollege.org from CFNC. And Clayworks, presenting Cups in Common, an exhibition of functional cups and mugs. Open now with a community celebration November 11th. Details at learnclay.com. One of President Trump's biggest Republican critics, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, bows out of re-election and in a bombshell speech on the Senate floor says he will no longer be complicit or silent about what he calls the president's reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior. That will be the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes to 10 o'clock during On Point with Tom Ashbrook. And we will be talking about art by the visually impaired for those who are disabled. That's coming right up.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
The legislature itself is not bound by this decree, is not party to the decree, even though they were defendants in the lawsuit. And if I were a judge, that would give me a pause about exactly how stable this really is.
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to artists who are by necessity working in a different way, both in experiential art, which we'll talk about as social practice art in just a moment, and also dance. Let me bring in Davian Robinson to this conversation. You're a double major at UNC Charlotte, dance and exercise science. I understand you were sighted until age 7 or 6 in somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yes.
Were you a dancer at all prior to that? I was pretty young, so were you a dancer at all prior to that?
No, I was, when I was young, around 7, when my vision started to deteriorate, I didn't dance, but I did athletics, rec ball, coach pitch, things of that nature. So I didn't start dancing until I was 12.
So what got you into dance? I would think at the age of 6, you really hadn't been exposed all that much to dance. You didn't know what it was. So well, what got you into it?
I would say I remember when I was 7, there was one point when I was at a party or something as a kid. There was like a dance contest thing. And I really, it was like I entered it, I didn't know what I was doing. It was just a thing. I was like, okay. It was like a talent show thing. I was like, oh, okay. So I was like, I did it. And all I knew was dance. I think it's because I saw things on TV or watching Michael Jackson on videos or something. It was cool. So, or breakdancing videos or something I was watching. I don't know remember what it was, but I think from that point, I was curious, but it was not a thought as I got older.
There's a company, I believe it's on the West Coast, of dancers, and part of what they do for people who don't have sight, who are in their audience, is provide them with essentially dolls that they can move the arms and legs and the bodies around so that they can feel what the dancers look like when they're in certain dance positions. How do you know what you're supposed to do? You're a choreographer too, right?
Yes.
So how do you know what you're doing, and how do you know if your dancers are doing what you have told
okay.
Them to
yeah.
Do.
So right now, I just got finished with a residency. I'm in a student performance this semester. I mean, not student performance, a staff performance, and I got casted in a piece done by a professional artist, Marcus White, and I have what is known as a dance mentor that. Dr. Karen Hubbard came up with my first semester here at UC Charlotte back in 2016 in the spring, and to help me navigate the space. Now, I'm no longer a visual learner. I'm more of a hands-on and auditorial learner, so movements. Since I have a background in tap and ballet, I am familiar with movement. And so what happens is there's movements, whether it be hands up, hands to the right, hands, you know, foot out to the right, or, you know, it's very descriptive in nature. As far as my dancers, it's most of my dances I come up with are improv-based to the point where it's sometimes structured. It doesn't always have to look a certain way for me, and I always have an overseer, like someone, a spotter, to say, you know, give me visual cues. Okay, what's this look like? What are you seeing? Because what the image of in my head looks like is totally different from what it outwardly looks like.
So Davian just mentioned you, Dr. Karen Hubbard, associate professor of dance. Is he the first, and I don't, excuse me, but I'm not sure what term you want me to use, non-visual. Is he the first non-visual dancer you've worked with?
Absolutely. I've had visually impaired students, but Davian was a very new experience. And the challenge was trying to find a way to include him in the class and in the courses. And I came up with the idea of I call it a movement mentor or a dance mentor.
How does that work?
So this person has to have had the course before. So they're familiar with the material. They're not learning the material and trying to help Davian at the same time. So they've already had the course, and they stick with Davian throughout the entire class, and they give him vocal cues and a hands-on manipulation.
So they actually help position you in a mm-hmm. certain way. If arms are supposed to be out straight and to the left, they'll make sure that you understand what that feels like so that you'll be in sync with everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Big challenge for everybody?
What?
Yeah. I would say it's a really big challenge. Uh-huh. Going from a visual learner to seeing all the choreography to having to trust someone who's skilled, you know, versed in what they're doing, it was a really hard challenge. But once I got to the point where I could trust them and that what they were telling me was great, you know, they're telling me, okay, you look good, keep going. You know, you're doing it right. Though this way, turn this way a little bit, or you need to relax here, you know, put a little bit more attention here, just different little things. It is a challenge, you know. So, yeah.
So Carmen Papalia is also with us. He was with us in the last segment. He's here now. Disability activist, artist in residence at the McCall Center for Art and Innovation. And you are a social practice artist. And I've got to tell you, I've never heard of that before yesterday. But Harold Fletcher, who directs the concentration at Portland State, where I believe you went to school, describes it in terms of what it isn't. He says it is the opposite of studio practice. It's not all about the artist, and it isn't assumed that work will go into a gallery. It doesn't have a look like cubism or pop art, and it has no central message like expressionism or surrealism. So can you please, because I don't know what any of that means, can you please describe what it is?
I think of it as an approach to art making that is very community-based. So instead of working on an object like in a studio, so making maybe a sculpture or an installation, you're working with people. I really think of it as a way of expressing my politics. I mean, a social practice, I feel, is the way that one interacts with the social space and people in their community. So I really just describe it as like a strategy, an approach, an ongoing kind of process that I'm continuously in, which is just like navigating various spaces, expressing my needs, making identifying various things that I might need to bring someone else in.
So it's very easy to understand it as activism. It's very easy to understand what you do as providing experiences for those who don't have sight or for those who do but want to understand what it is like to not have sight. But what makes it art?
Well, I don't even think I'd categorize my work as being for – you know, I don't think people are assuming my position when they are shutting their eyes, say. Like I do this walking tour where people line up behind me and link arms and shut their eyes. And I don't think of it really as a simulation of my experience because I think that there's part of that that people cannot access. I think of it more as just time spent – intentional time spent with eyes shut, exercise for the non-visual senses because I feel like I've had a lot of time to exercise those senses, and that's the way like I navigate my surroundings. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just pretty much bringing people into a space that I feel comfortable in. And so, yeah, I would say that my work is a form of activism, but I think it operates differently because I think you can achieve something different through creative practice that you can't by standing in protest.
So your work has been featured in exhibitions at the Whitney Museum of American Art, the LA Craft and Folk Art Museum, and elsewhere. Is your work here part of what has been called the Open Access Project?
Yes.
Talk about that.
So in the last couple of years, I have been on this movement building campaign for what I call open access. In 2015, I wrote 5 tenets, like guiding principles for this intentional space. It's really just like a proposal. It's a conceptual framework. So 5 short paragraphs that kind of like describe a space that doesn't really exist unless people really make it. And really, it's just like a flipping of the or an inversion of the typical policy-based model for accessibility. Usually when someone, is seeking support, they're engaging an accommodation. It's also like, you know, it's based in policies. You're usually talking about the disability community. Open access is more like thinking about how power is distributed within a system, how that relates to one's agency or freedom of movement within a system. So it's not necessarily about the disability community specifically, but more about like the various ways, the social, cultural, political conditions that might obstruct one's agency.
So why choose a pathway through the world of art for that as opposed to simply a pathway through the world of social activism and consciousness raising, for lack of a better term, or politics for that matter?
I mean, I feel like that's those are the spaces that I can access, like awareness raising, shifting perceptions, and also cultural shifts. I think within institutions, I'm able to work, you know, so this open access movement building campaign, I've been introducing this new framework that I developed. It's really just a piece of writing that really directs people away or maybe in sort of different ways in connecting with others and making person-to-person agreements for support. So I've actually been introducing this model to, you know, staff at museums, at universities, at city departments. So I'm actually able to, working as an artist within the museum system and in galleries, like, you know, kind of move into different spaces, you know, whether it be kind of like, you know, city government. I talk to policymakers as well, but I think that's like a really slow game. Yeah. So
you might reach more people more quickly through this avenue, is what
yeah,
you're saying?
Yeah.
Davian, you're a dancer, and I'm curious about how somebody without sight experiences dance.
Yeah. But I experience dance very, very differently than I could ever think. A lot of times when we think of dance, there's this ballet, there's this structure to it, there's modern, there's this structure to it. There's this element of dance where it's more than just the aesthetic look of it, than more so it's what it feels like. And when when dancers as artists are here to express emotions, come up with choreography or stories to tell through dance. From my perspective, it's all about inwardly more so than outwardly. If we as people and individuals can get past the comparisons, the perfections, the insecurities that we all sometimes hold due to the perceived stigmas and that are put on us by societal pressures, then we can be free of that, to be able to dance the dance of dance and to bring art to its fullest potential as an artist.
There are a lot of fully sighted people, Dr. Hubbard, who think they're executing the choreography that they've been told to execute, but in fact are not, which is why the choreographer has to continually say, no, straighten that arm, straighten your back, do something else, because that's not what everybody else is doing. And that's a challenge for fully sighted people. Is there any real difference here? Because you're not even a fully sighted person, unless they're standing in front of a mirror, is not seeing precisely what they're doing.
Well, I think in the end, for the dancer, for the expressive dancer, the movement comes from the inside out. So Davian, you know, has a handle on how he approaches the work, and it would be helpful if young dancers could learn how to do that, to experience movement from the inside out. But the thing is that we're all hung up on looking at the mirror. How do we look in the mirror instead of trying to experience the movement from the inside out?
Carmen talks about disrupting the social, cultural, and political conditions that, these are his words, obstruct the agency of one who is visually impaired. And I would imagine the presence of a visually impaired dancer in a company of other dancers provides that disruption rather quickly. What has the inclusion of Davian in your company meant to the company?
I think to dancers in the class and to dancers in the performance practicum, my observation is that he is included in the work. I don't see them distracted by him being there with a movement mentor. I feel like they are protective of him if necessary, but I don't feel like they're apprehensive that he's going to bump into them or anything. It has been such an enriching experience. When he first came to my class, I was trying to find out how to accommodate him, and I found information on courses that were totally made up of visually impaired students. But this is very different. We are including him in the class as a regular student, and it has worked. It's wonderful.
You're also a cyclist and a Paralympian. Is that correct, David?
Yes, I'm a paracyclist and a Paralympic hopeful. Yes, I compete nationally around the country in paracycling. I'm ranked third in the nation on the track and on the road as a tandem cyclist. And last summer, I competed in the 2016 Rio Games and missed going. But I am shooting for the 2020 Paralympic Games in Tokyo, and I have my national championships coming up at the first week of December. So it's been a really awesome ride to look at all that plus my dance and really seeing the benefits of it. Wow. As a cross-sectional thing.
Susan in Indian Trail emails, I'm a visually impaired poet and my first book will be published next year and it feels like vindication. Hopefully others in my situation can find validation while others can further their understanding. Glad to know there are other local artists doing the same thing. Thank you both for being here. You can get more information about both the dance and some of the things that Carmen Papalia is doing with his open access demonstration at our website at wfae.org. Thanks.
Thank you.